Thursday night edition of the Downtown Basketball Podcast. The Warriors live to fight another day, 120-111 in Oakland. We're also going to talk about the Indiana Pacers and their offseason under new head coach Nate McMillan. They're going to have between 25 and a little under $32 million in space. So we'll talk about what they're going to do with that, what their team needs might be. But Danny, first of all, let's talk about the Warriors scratching one out here.
Yeah, this was to me the first truly fun game of the series, and it was more like what I had hoped for from it, but some strong performances all around.
Yeah, I thought the biggest thing to me was that the Golden State defense showed up in a way that it certainly didn't in Oklahoma City when they gave up 72 points in each of the first halves there. And a couple of adjustments that they made, both of which were things that we had called for. One of them was that they guarded Robertson more conventionally at the start. That, I think, helped them just stay solid, not give up a bunch of easy looks with him doing a nice job of cutting on the baseline. He ended up only 2 out of 5, did hit two out of three threes still. He's been on fire with that. He's shooting better in the games than he shoots it in his warm-ups at this point. And so that was one. Another one was playing Andrew Bogut more. Kerr talked about how he got in foul trouble, and that was a problem. But then again, he only had like 3 fouls. You know, you could always bring him back if you only know that he's going to play 20 to 25 minutes. But I thought he played extremely well. And then the last thing that I also thought, I had no idea why they weren't doing, was they switched everything 1 through 4 again, and they had Draymond Green get out on Russell Westbrook and Kevin Durant instead of trying to play normal pick-and-roll defense. And I can't remember a single time that Green actually got beat on one of those plays.
Yeah, I mean, there was one, I think, where he got beaten, but he got back in time to contest the shot, and, you know, that's close enough. And the stat for me on that was that the Thunder were 8 for 18 in the restricted area and 7 for 19 in the paint non-restricted area.
Yeah, so, and they took a lot less free throws, too. And many will complain about the calls. They definitely had a lot of drives in the first quarter that were not called. We've noted before that, for whatever reason, less fouls are called statistically in the first quarter, and that was definitely the case tonight. I didn't think that any of those, at least from what I could see, were that egregious, and there was a difference because those shots weren't occurring right at the rim. You know, they're occurring with a body in between them, around some arms, kind of going not directly towards the basket, sort of more facing the baseline, maybe out by like the block. And it was just a matter of degree, but you saw how many more shots they had to take in the paint, but not in the restricted area. And that's because Golden State was staying solid, had guys there to help at the rim and contest. And then they weren't so out of position that they were forced to foul. And I thought that was a big thing. And then Green just played a lot better, too. I mean, it's hard to divorce the difference between the scheme and just he and Bogut having more energy, doing a better job at contesting.
Yeah, it is really hard to separate that. And you have to give credit to both them for the performance, particularly on the interior. Something else I thought was interesting, that while Oklahoma City doesn't emphasize it in their offense based on where they space people, they only attempted 3 corner 3s in this game. And they made one of them, was Robertson, made one of his 2 from there. But to me, while they don't have the greatest personnel for that, it is still a way to space out the defense and to generate possibilities that they just didn't really execute in this game.
I thought the Warriors trusted their defense at the point of attack more in this one. They did not overhelp. They weren't leaving Robertson as much. Deion Waiters was 0 for 3. He wasn't getting, you know, those wide open threes or his chances to drive off a closeout as much. And they just dealt with the fact that KD and Russ were going to shoot a lot. They were going to make some great shots, but that overall in the aggregate, they were going to be, you know, shooting plays one-on-one that are just hard to generate great shots, especially if you pack the paint and force them to shoot from mid-range. And then they're not going to be able to generate that many points for others either. And that was pretty key in preventing guys like Robertson and Waiters from getting off.
I also thought that this was the least great game that Steven Adams had played in the series. I know he wasn't bad by any means. Part of that could be attributed to his early foul trouble. He got 2 fouls pretty early in the game, and then they had to go to the Megadeth lineup earlier than they expected, and I think that did throw them off rhythm a little bit. But it was also notable that we discussed earlier in the series that the Thunder had basically gone down to a 7-man rotation. Today it was 6, Waiters have played 26 minutes off the bench. Nobody else played more than 8, and I think Randy Foy, you know, he wasn't particularly impactful during his time, except for one strong post defensive play, which you enjoyed immensely. And so that, I think that the number and importance there, I mean, you brought up that Waiters wasn't really scoring. He actually had 0 points in the game. But the fact that they're able to rely on those guys is so good, but you also need them to play to give you at least a little bit of something. And they ended up getting something from Morrow, which was beyond shocking.
Yeah, although the defense did struggle a little bit more when he's out there. I mean, he provides a weak link to go against, which is really not present aside from Enes Kanter, who only played 6 minutes, and Billy Donovan basically said, you know, the matchups weren't great for him, which is correct. He's, by the way, everyone who's like, oh my god, Enes Kanter is going to be unplayable, like, he's getting pretty close to unplayable. He played 6 minutes in this game, all of which I believe occurred when Steph Curry was out of the game. The Thunder, I thought, played a pretty darn good game, though. Like, you their defense, they did give up a fair amount of fast break points. They did turn it over a fair amount. Russ had 7 turnovers. But their defense in the half court was pretty excellent. And one stat that shows that is, you know, the NBA has these new hustle stats. And the Warriors, a team renowned supposedly for their illegal screening, generated 3 screen assists the entire night, which is basically a screen that leads to a bucket. And that's because the Thunder are just switching pretty much every screen. And the Warriors were able to get some back doors. Those passes were connecting tonight, those tough passes, instead of getting deflected as they were at Oklahoma City. And there's, you know, some of that I think is just kind of the bounce of the ball. I mean, they were really fitting it through some tight windows on some of those back doors. But the Thunder are taking the Warriors completely out of what they would normally be doing offensively with the switching. And the Warriors, I mean, to put up a buck 20 on this Thunder defense that, you know, made some mistakes on occasion, but I thought it was still very, very good overall.
Yeah, I thought they played well, and while Stephen Curry did put up a better night, and I thought he looked better than he has in other games, he still, for me, is below 100%, you know, and it was after we recorded after game 4 that Adrian Wojnarowski's reporting about him being about 70%, you know, was out there. But to me, he looked better than he did in game 4, but he still wasn't killing when it was a big switched on him. He wasn't he was attacking more, but not really in the same way that he does when he's at his best.
He finally had one of those awesome Steph finishes, which I think really the first one of the series, where he just lofted it over a shot blocker for an and one, I think in the fourth quarter. And then at the end too, he was able to blow by Steven Adams when they finally went to, I guess, let's still call it the death lineup for convenience, even though they got completely destroyed, and I don't want to call it that anymore, but with Green at center. And he finally was able to just blow by Adams and get a layup because there wasn't enough help due to the three-point shooting around him. And I do think that Kerr should at least give that unit a try in Game 6 and see maybe if it can get going. But, you know, and have a short leash for it, probably. But we'll see. I mean, also, like, he was clearly concerned down the end about potentially hacking Bogut, and I think he didn't use Azili for that reason as well at the end of the first quarter because they were in the penalty.
Yeah, they might have been saved a little bit by Festus Azili in his second half stint hitting both of the free throws when he got hacked, because Donovan just went away from it. I mean, that's not the way that you're supposed to do that. If it's a good decision, it stays a good decision. It's not like Azili's going to be making his free throws the rest of the night. He's not Steven Adams in this playoffs. So you have to deal with that. And actually, the threat of the bonus was one of the Kerr things. He did a nice job with his rotations in this game. Not a lot of scrub time. But the big exception to that was he didn't want to go to Azili when the Warriors were already in the bonus in the first quarter. And for whatever reason, he didn't think Mo Spates could play another 3 minutes. So he went to Anderson Varejão, and those were some minutes where the Warriors lost points that they almost ended up needing.
Yeah, Varejão gave up a 3 to Serge Ibaka in the corner by overhelping in a situation where it wasn't really needed. He did have one beautiful backdoor, but also like gave up a couple of offensive rebounds. Just didn't really do much. He's pretty much a non-threat out there, and I prefer not to play him, but if he's only playing 3 minutes, maybe it's not the absolute end of the world. So a couple other notes before we get into maybe some more minutia. I mean, what did you think of the refereeing? Like, Donovan was really almost subtweeting the refs. He did get a T late. He mentioned the free throw differential, which was a surprise to me because while the Warriors shot 34 free throws, most of that was due to the difference, and the Thunder shot 24, that extra 10, a lot of that was due to just intentional fouls down the end. But I think he was talking more about Steven Adams getting in foul trouble early, one of which was on kind of like a weird illegal screenplay, and then also just the fact that they couldn't buy a call at the rim in the first quarter. Did you think that the refereeing was fair, unfair? What are your thoughts?
I thought it was pretty close to fair. There were plays that Oklahoma City, you know, that were kind of, let's say, judgment calls that they weren't getting, but it didn't seem like that was an issue of being inconsistent. It's also weird because the Warriors don't draw that many fouls in that way. When they get to the line, it can sometimes be different. But I didn't see anything that was egregious in that way. And as you mentioned, not only was it the intentional fouls at the end, but the Thunder also periodically intentionally fouled at other points in the game, including Azili, and the Warriors never did that. So that's a lot of the margin. And yeah, Russ and KD weren't getting those, but the character of their almost fouls was fundamentally different than it was in Game 3 and Game 4, let's say. And so, yeah, the free throw disparity was different, but the plays were different. And I also thought that the refereeing was somewhat consistent, and while I didn't think it was perfect, I didn't think it was egregious one way or the other. They called weird passing crashes. They also called one I thought was kind of shaky offensive foul against Iguodala, just kind of on the same vein. So they were doing that both ways. And incidentally, one thing, I don't think it's going to matter in terms of the suspension, but I'm going to be interested in seeing how the league handles Steven Adams throwing an uncalled elbow at Sean Livingston's head.
Yeah, he's not going to get suspended for it. If Draymond didn't get suspended and Adams did, you know, there would be a complete riot in Oklahoma City, and perhaps justifiably so, though there's a lot less plausible deniability in terms of the intentionality. And actually, Green had another play where he kicked Russell Westbrook in the head, but that was, I mean, as I've said before, sometimes when you land and you're just trying to balance, you just like bring your leg up like that, and he's somewhat of an awkward player. I don't think that was particularly intentional either. But in any event, another key stretch of this game was the 8-0 run at the start of the fourth for Golden State's bench, going against, in large part, OKC's frontline players. I think Adams and Durant were out there to start. Then they even were going up against Russ, Durant, and Adams, and still somehow scored them 8-0. Most Bates got a couple free throws that were a little dubious. He had an and one that was not dubious. That was a good call with Durant sliding underneath him. I'm sure Durant was sort of like thinking he was going to take the charge on Spates because Spates had gotten a completely terrible pass and crash on him earlier. And, of course, sprained his ankle last year, too. But if he just jumps, most Bates are not going to make that layup.
Yeah, and again, that's kind of why we would like to change the rule, is because you don't want to encourage the behavior that it encouraged. And Sean Livingston had a hand in almost all of those plays as well. He had the assist to Spates on that and one, though it shouldn't have been an assist. Absolutely not. He also had two baskets of his own and had the pass in transition to Barnes, who they just never got at the top of the key, which was actually ended up being a big lift for the crowd. And I thought the crowd did a much better job in this game than the other two at Oracle.
Yeah, it was back. It definitely was. I mean, Steve Kerr sent out a message on Facebook and by the Twitter saying, hey, we need you there. Get there early. Nobody got there early because traffic was just completely ridiculous and it's a 6 o'clock start. But everyone who was there was totally crazy. It definitely was just as good of an atmosphere as it was in Oklahoma City, from what I could tell. I don't know why it was so weird in Game 1 and only slightly better than in Game 2. Maybe it's just simply expectations, and these fans feed more off of being an underdog, which the Warriors kind of are. What do you make of their chances now going into Oklahoma City? Did they find something in this game, or do you kind of still think they're not looking too good in Game 6?
I think that they definitely played better in this game, but I don't think they found anything, and I don't think they played well enough to do it, but they're at the place where they can make that step up. They're going to, you know, they need to make fewer mistakes. They need to, you know, that's not only just turnovers. There are also some ill-advised shots, particularly Klay Thompson. I sometimes get fixated on his shot selection. And if they can clean up that kind of stuff and play the defense that they played in this game, though, they can absolutely win a game on the road in the series.
Yeah, I do think that part of why they succeeded in this game was they made adjustments. We talked about what they did defensively, even little stuff like making sure to pass fake more often before throwing a pass. Like, there was only one like crazy deflection I recall of just like what looked like a normal pass, and there were probably like eight of those in game four, for example. They also, another thing we had talked about was just pump faking more in the lane, and Steph Curry in particular did more of that, attacking under control. Bogut did more of that too, and they were able to, that was a little bit of an adjustment, so the Thunder rim protection, while they did still hold them to 20 out of 37 at the rim, wasn't quite as impactful, and the Warriors were able to at least get fouled a little bit more on some of those plays as well. But that said, I do think that this wasn't a dominating victory for the Warriors, and if they do, and Steph still, you know, didn't have a dominating game despite the 31 points. A lot of those were intentional fouls late. He looked a little bit better taking guys off the dribble, but still not fantastic. And also, you're relying on Andrew Bogut to play a good game on the road, which I can't remember what the last time he did that was.
You asked me that during the game, and I looked it up, and the first one that you can make a credible argument for, at least in the regular season, was back in February. He had a nice game, a solid game against Orlando. So, I mean, if you're digging back 3 months, that's a little bit scary. But the Warriors, you know, the Warriors have the talent, and even if Curry is at 70, 80%, whatever, they can still get it done. It's just so much harder when he's not driving that extra attention.
They played at a little slower pace, too. You know, we talked about how there were 58 possessions in the first half of that game four. Absolutely turbocharged. Tonight, they're only 103, 50 in the first half. So that's still very fast for an NBA game. You know, that would still lead the league. But it's not just, like, absolutely, completely insane. They were getting back on defense. I mean, I think, and the Thunder, while they did defend pretty well in terms of, like, their communication and forcing the Warriors to go one-on-one and not being able to use screens, they did not defend it quite the crazy fever pitch from an effort level, and the Warriors' effort was better as well. When you're at home, when you're down 3-1, that's sort of what ends up happening. So we'll see. I mean, you remember what the atmosphere was like in OKC with all those Thunder athletes running around. It just seems so inevitable, like, once the game starts. And, I mean, I've never believed more in just the craziness of home court advantage than I have after this series. So I do think the Thunder are still substantial favorites to win. But if they don't, the Warriors are going to feel pretty good coming back home for Game 7. But it's going to take an absolutely epic effort for the Warriors to win. And I do think the Thunder are still favored. That doesn't mean it's impossible for the Warriors. But they're just going to have to grind it out defensively, because I don't think that Steph is there to just bring them home on his own the way he has at times.
And even though Draymond's little meltdown didn't occur in the first quarter in this game, I think that the first quarter will be pivotal, because we will see how disciplined the Warriors can be in terms of keeping their heads defensively and offensively. And if they can make it through that stretch clean, pretty much for me, regardless of what the score is, I think that's more about just watching them and seeing how they're playing. If they can do that, then I think they'll have a much better chance. But that hasn't been the case. They had those weird struggles in both games in Oklahoma City so far.
Yeah, it's imperative that they keep it close early, because this is a Thunder team that there is going to be some pressure on them now. They have had a 3-1 lead nominally. Granted, only 29% of road teams that were up 3-1 actually won the resulting Game 5, per Dan Feldman's research. But, you know, there's a feeling that, hey, we were in this great commanding position. And they, while it's not an elimination game in that Game 6, everyone knows what the statistics are for a road Game 7. And we've seen that teams who are the home team have a much, much better chance of coming back from down 3-1. And at least the Warriors at least have done a third of what they need to do now.
Yeah, it's a pretty major step.
All right, some smaller notes here. In the second quarter, the Thunder were absolutely on fire, going 11 out of 18. They were 5 out of 7 for mid-range, 3 of 5 on threes in that period. But they also had 8 turnovers on their 26 possessions, and that was key for the Warriors. The Warriors actually were able to get 13 steals in this one, 15 turnovers, 13 steals for the Warriors, whereas 17 turnovers for the Thunder and 13 steals for the Warriors. Still an astronomical amount. Their hands were much better defensively. I mean, I do think in Game 6, the way the game is called is going to be huge. If it's a tight whistle, that massively favors the Thunder. If it is a more loose whistle, the Warriors love to reach in more. You know, whereas the Thunder are getting deflections on passes in the air, the Warriors reach in with their hands. That's how they get a lot of deflections. So, and then also the Thunder are just going to relentlessly go to the rim. They have guys who seek out the contact. What are the calls going to be on those plays? That's going to be pretty critical.
Agreed, and it's also going to be key. Something that was a big swing in this that we talked about was that in the fourth quarter in particular, the Thunder struggled to handle a subpar, I guess you could call it, Warriors lineup. And I think one of the insights that you had that I think was notable and right is that they weren't used to not having to switch.
Yeah, that's true. They actually play conventionally when Cantor is out there, when Curry and Clay aren't out there. There's no reason to switch, you would think, but... And Cantor is not that good at it, but there's also no one who's really that much of a threat for the Warriors either, and the Thunder were almost just sort of out of practice for playing normal defense, it seemed like. I think another reason that the Warriors will have the advantage late is because the Thunder really devolve even more offensively into just very, very predictable actions, and it was a 1-5 pick and roll or a 3-5 pick and roll basically every time, and Bogut was doing a nice job. They were attacking him, but he was laying back well enough to prevent the pass to the roll guy. Russ and KD were sort of getting to the free throw line and making some amazing shots at times, but also missing some pretty well-contested ones. And I think the Warriors feel like they can do better than that. Offensively, can get some better looks down the stretch of games. At one point, they tried to have Robertson set the screen, and on the first time, because Steph was guarding him, on the first time, Steph just double-teamed Durant and tried to force him to just throw it to Robertson on a short roll. And the second time, it was so predictable, Green just switched on to Robertson and then switched on to KD. So I don't think that involving Robertson is necessarily going to be that effective for them either.
I agree with you. And it's really easy to snuff out. That's one of the problems for Oklahoma City under Brooks, and it's still there, is that they just don't have enough variety and they don't have enough real nuance to get into stuff. We talked about that with Portland, actually, that Portland was doing a nice job of setting things up even if you kind of knew what was coming. And Oklahoma City just doesn't have that wiggle in their game.
Yeah, and it really is so remarkable, right? The Warriors love the fast break. They feed on chaos. They have these great defenders who are long, and they get a bunch of wide-open threes. The Thunder, if they're going to score, they have to feed on chaos as well. The effort plays, block shots, turnovers, getting out in transition, and I mean, I think just the free throws and the fast break points are just going to be so key in this Game 6, and if the Warriors can keep them out of transition, can just avoid sort of being overwhelmed athletically, slow the pace down, not ridiculously so, but enough to 50 possessions instead of 60 per half, then I think I like their chances a lot better. Any other thoughts that you had on this one before we move on to a little bit of news?
No, I think that's about it.
All right, we actually have a lot to catch up on with Mike D'Antoni getting hired, David Fizdale reportedly getting hired as well with the Grizzlies. But first, let's talk about Athletes Collective, a new sponsor for us. They are an apparel company with the same quality as some of the big boys, but they're not trying to get you with their logo. They're trying to get you with quality. And they don't have all sorts of endorsements or logos, and that's why they can offer you the same quality of stuff at a cheaper price. They sent me some stuff. I actually had my best workout in months in their gear last Friday. And my girlfriend also likes the way that their stuff looks. It's just simple stuff, long sleeve t-shirt, cutoff t-shirt, regular t-shirt, shorts. That's about it. You know, as many colors as you want, but no logos, just simple, and owning plenty of stuff from the major brands. I can confirm that their quality is just as good, if not better. In fact, their stuff is pre-shrunk. So if you're a single guy, you can just wash them and dry them as many times as you like. You don't have to worry about hanging them. A lot of times, sort of athletic stuff that's made to wick sweat away will shrink a lot. This is not going to do that. So they'll never lose their original shape or their ability to keep you dry when you sweat. So you can go to athletescollective.com, enter the promo code CAPSPACE, and you get a nice discount, 15% off of your first order, and they include free shipping and returns to the U.S. or Canada. 100% satisfaction guaranteed at athletescollective.com. Make sure you use that CAPSPACE code so they know that you came from us. What do you think of Mike D'Antoni in Houston?
I like Mike D'Antoni as a coach. I think that there are a lot of things that he does well, and I think he is a great player in terms of getting, kind of utilizing smaller, even less talented players, you know, as assets. He can do, like, building assets out of those kind of players. I just don't see the fit with Houston. I mean, James Harden is a magnificent offensive player, but he already kind of is what he is, and I'm not sure that D'Antoni's reach will really make him better as a creator. And in terms of big men, depending, of course, on who they bring in, because that could change a lot, I don't think they have great personnel for him. They don't have an Amari Stoudemire. They don't really have a guy who's as versatile as he is offensively, or the kind of beast that he is. So I don't love it, but I'm open to it because Houston has the flexibility that they do.
This does not seem like a hire that is designed to address Houston's weaknesses. They were a top 10 offense against all odds, mostly on the back of James Harden this year. They already shoot a ton of threes. They already play at a pretty fast pace. So while I do think he will try to get some more movement for them, although a lot of his offense, while it's known for movement and pushing the pace, a lot of it is just put the ball in the hands of the point guard and, you know, let him create and then find shooters. You know, he definitely is going to make sure that they have enough shooting on the floor at the four at all times. They're going to really have to improve their personnel. I would say that this hiring, we know what Dwight Howard thinks of him due to his L.A. time. So you have to imagine that'll really lessen the odds, if not make it assured that Howard will not return. Donatas Mata-Yunas, yeah, I can shoot the three a little bit. Still not quite a knockdown guy yet. Terrence Jones, also, you really think they're going to try to find some more shooting at the four or to just go in the direction of maybe a combo forward who can shoot the three at the four as well. I do think that James Harden is pretty likely to have a great season under D'Antoni. And they're talking about Jeff Bezdelic, who is a pretty decent defensive assistant by reputation and had some good defenses with some talentless Nugget teams back in the way early 2000s when they were bad enough to get Carmelo Anthony. I don't know. It doesn't address that many of their weaknesses, though, because D'Antoni has never really been known as a defensive coach. But let me ask you this. Is there any other coach that we're aware of on the market that you could say would have been a better candidate than him at this point?
Not of the people that were still available. I loved Vogel and Van Gundy there, but once those coaches were off the board, you know, D'Antoni has upside, and if they change their talent, it could be better suited. So I can't knock it too hard if you were taking those coaches off.
Another thing for D'Antoni, too, is he is not a guy who has really succeeded that much, certainly not in his last two stops with the emotional aspects of coaching. Obviously, he wasn't able to really get Howard and Pau Gasol to buy in that much. A lot of people think that basically Carmelo Anthony wanted him fired, and he ended up resigning as a result of not really getting along with him that much. There was the tension between Lin and Carmelo that a lot of people have alluded to. And then even in Phoenix, D'Antoni and Kerr weren't able to get along either. So again, it doesn't seem like D'Antoni is going to be sort of the galvanizing leader of men, but who's also going to hold James Harden accountable defensively. But who knows? Maybe that guy wasn't there. You know, maybe that was Frank Vogel, who supposedly there was some talk, but certainly he was never offered the job, it would seem like. And I don't know even how extensively he interviewed. And the other thing that I think is a little interesting here, and this is just my speculation, so don't go too far with this, but it seems like this is not exclusively a Daryl Morey hire. We've seen things like Kenny Smith reportedly interviewing and being a candidate because he knows Les Alexander, and these coaches meeting, having second interviews where they meet with Les Alexander, the owner, one-on-one. And I don't know, it just doesn't seem to me like Daryl and D'Antoni are quite like the same type of guys. But that's just my opinion. I don't know. I'm kind of speculating a little bit there.
You are, but I had the same feeling. So, you know, that's just two people who weren't super plugged into it, but having the same instinct.
Well, you know who's the happiest guy about this move?
I'm intrigued to find out the answer.
Brett Brown.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there was that reporting out of Philly that Brown might not even make it through the summer, that if there was another offer given to D'Antoni that they might just move forward. Now, the Houston job is probably better than the Philly job anyway, so even if they had offered it to D'Antoni, he might not have taken it. But, or maybe that reporting was just incorrect. I mean, more of it was along the lines of, yeah, if they struggle, then they'll just elevate D'Antoni. I don't think politically that they could extend Braun, and there's already sort of some bad optics about Brian Colangelo coming in. So him just dumping Brett Brown, who never really had a chance with any kind of a real roster. Not that I thought he did a great job last year, but that probably wouldn't have looked too good.
It would not have. And I think we should might as well get to the other coaching hire, which is David Fizdale, longtime assistant, most recently with the Miami Heat, getting what Woj and The Vertical are reporting is a four-year contract to be the head coach of the Memphis Grizzlies.
Yeah, Fizdale, longtime Heat assistant. He supposedly is one of the guys who really preaches ball movement a lot. A lot of Miami-Memphis connections these days. They had that trade. They had two trades, right? I think. Yeah, they had the Chris Anderson trade, and they had the Mario Chalmers trade this year. I do think that they will be incredibly awesome when the other team tries to take a three-pointer in front of their bench. That's one thing that Dave Vizdel brings.
Yeah, he really does.
He might like move to the top of coach closeouts with Vinny Del Negro out of the league now. I've always never particularly enjoyed that. It's kind of bush league. But nonetheless, I think that Fizdale was someone who's been talked about as a candidate for a while, comes out of that Heat culture, but we just have no idea what kind of team he's actually going to have to coach. But it would be good for the Grizz to get some stability there. Also, we should mention D'Antoni, 3-year contract, 4th-year team option. Monetary terms were not disclosed as far as I saw with Houston.
Yeah, that's also important to note.
Some other chickens we've been talking about for quite a long time came home to roost today with the release of the All-NBA teams. The biggest news, Anthony Davis did not make an All-NBA team, which I thought was pretty unfair. He should have been, but I had him as my first team center, but didn't play that many games. I don't think he really got many votes at center. If I had been his representation, I would have been pushing him really hard in the media as a center because there's a lot less competition there. But he didn't make it. Therefore, he did not qualify for the Derrick Rose rule, and his 5-year contract will now be for a little bit under 25% of the cap, or at least starting in 2016, rather than 30%. So that's going to cost him about $24 million, depending on where the cap comes in.
And going the other direction, Damian Lillard made his second All-NBA team, and that means that he qualifies for the Rose Rule. However, it was part of the agreement that he made with Portland when he signed his extension last summer that instead of getting the full 30%, he will only get 27.5%. So while Davis dropped about $24 million, Lillard only gets about 12. And he, unlike other players who have made a similar thing, who made a similar concession, I guess you could call it, a lot of those players did so and secured a player option on the 5th year. He did not. He's a straight 5 years, so he left that money on the table for the good of the team, or however you want to phrase it, and it will give them some extra latitude.
Yeah, you had to imagine Portland would have thought that he wasn't going to make it because they were rebuilding this year, but they had a great performance, and I don't know that I would have had him second team. I think I had Kyle Lowry on my second team, but I think I did have him on the third team. And I think we have to talk about, though, just how completely ridiculous it is that, A, it's variable, even like that you're limited to 25% on your first max contract. I mean, because if you think about it, when are NBA players' best seasons? Probably from like your 4th to your 7th or 8th season for most players. And so the idea that you can't even get the 30% max until you have 7 years of experience, so your 8th season, and then you can't even get the 35% max until your 11th season, you have to have 10 years of experience. I don't understand why that is. Like it's the only guys who are eligible for the 35% max who could even remotely plausibly get it this year are Wade, Howard, and LeBron James. Like, you are shunting money to guys who, other than James, probably don't deserve it, frankly. And so I think that you should just, I think the rookie scale is good, but once you get off of the rookie scale, you should be able to go up to the 35% max right away. That would really solve a lot of these problems with the inequities of the distribution. And I think teams don't want that because they want rookie extension talks to be simpler. You know, if you could get 35%, would Portland have just given that to Lillard? Probably not. You know, there would have been some negotiation there. It would have been harder. But I think it would allow there to be more upside for the true superstars, whereas guys who are, you know, sort of an Andre Drummond type, you know, maybe he only deserves 25% of the cap instead of 35%. And then, of course, you also don't have the complete farce of fan voting in the case of all-star starters, or media voting determining who's actually going to get paid or not.
And not only is it media voting, but something that is a bugaboo for me is media voting when many of them are employees of teams. And that can be flawed in a lot of different ways, but I personally don't love that part of it as well.
Another piece of news, Joe Cowley, who I don't necessarily view as that reliable of a source when it comes to the Bulls because he really seems to have an axe to grind against Bulls management. He's a former columnist. He reported that Noah is telling teammates that he is done in Chicago. That wouldn't surprise me, frankly, after kind of how things have gone the last couple of years with signing Gasol. There's then later been pushback from his agent, Bill Duffy, through Casey Johnson and Nick Friedell, saying that, no, there continue to be some discussions about potentially coming back to Chicago, and he hasn't made a decision. However, I do think that the Bulls need to move on, if they can, from both Noah and Gasol. Noah is too injury prone to just count on him as a starting center, and they desperately need a good defensive starting center. I think they would be better off going with their $20 million, go into the market for a Biombo or a Jan Mahimi type of guy. That should be their number one free agent priority to me. So I think Noah needs to be on a team that isn't absolutely counting on him, where he can play 25 minutes a game really hard, but maybe still be the nominal starter. What do you think of that? Should the Bulls be trying to re-sign him, or should they be trying to do a little bit better?
I don't think he's a great fit. Of course, if he wants to come back and we'll take a discount, you consider that. Though I don't even consider that a lock. You know, if he were willing to do that, and he deserves to make his money. I would like to see him, as you mentioned, as a player who is a part of the center rotation and an important part of the center rotation. I don't care whether he starts or he doesn't start, but I would also love to see him go to a team that has impressionable young guys that he can teach, especially if they can be big men, that he can really work with them, whether that be a team that drafts a center high this year or even a team that has that player on their roster already. I would love to see him in that kind of role. I've thought about Orlando, depending on what they do at center. There are a couple other teams that would be worth considering. And I also think that going the idea of a smaller role, if he wants to compete for a championship or playoff relevant, I think that's the most likely path. If what he wants to do is start, it's very unlikely to me that he will end up somewhere where the team will be competitive.
Hey, I mean, he could be the starter on a team that needs the center, but maybe closes games small a lot of times. He just needs a lot of shooting around him offensively, and guys who know how to move without the ball. I think that defensively, he looked like he was pretty close to back last year. Granted, he's now 31, but I did think he looked better physically. He was starting to get his confidence a little bit on offense. I still think the odds are, though, that he's going to be pretty useless offensively other than his passing and offensive rebounding. So you just got to have enough offense around him. And then, of course, he still remains an injury risk also. One other very small note, Thomas Robinson is opting out of his Nets contract. He was signed for close to the minimum. I think he could be a fourth big for someone. He protected the rim better this year, still has some physical talent, and you know, probably the right move for him to opt out in this market, I would say.
Yeah, one other thing I want to note is that Jonathan Givony of Draft Express reported that Dragan Bender, one of the more fascinating European prospects, a guy who's in play from three all the way on down, his buyout is more manageable. I believe it's about $1.5 million. And $1.5 million is an amount that only the team can only pay half of, just with the rules with the NBA buyout, assuming he goes in the first round, and he will.
Yeah, a little less than that even. $650,000
right.
Is the what is known as the excluded international player payment, and that's the amount that teams can just pay basically off the books to get guys out of their contract. But if he gets drafted third or fourth, and it's actually $1.3 million, Givony reported.
Right, that's
so you're
that,
right,
it is half.
Yeah. Yeah, that's not that big. I mean, if they can pay the $650,000, and then you know he'll be making close to $5 million a year, so he'll have to pay the rest of that $650,000 out of his salary, but that shouldn't be a problem.
And that means he can come over right away.
Yeah, and the remaining is just has to be paid later. It doesn't even have to be paid right away, according to what his contract is. So it shouldn't be an impediment. That's good news. It would be nice to see him come over right away. And he is a guy, due to his lack of strength, who really needs to come over and get into an NBA strength program immediately. You wouldn't want him to be overseas for another year.
Yeah, and I'm excited because it also really helps his draft stock, because you don't have that question mark that it looked like it was going to be earlier on. And I from what I've seen, I haven't watched a ton of him yet. I want to watch a lot more. I love his fit in an NBA system with the right coaching.
All right, we're going to get to the Pacers in a second. Let's talk about Vistaprint.com first, however. Vistaprint has been a key resource for me in trying to build my small business. That's what this podcast is. And they are now offering 500 business cards for just $9.99 when you enter my promo code CAPSPACE at checkout. Remember, CAPSPACE, we talk about it all the time in the program. That's what it is for all of our sponsors. And Vistaprint doesn't just offer business cards. It's a one-stop print shop with tons of custom products for home or office needs, postcards, flyers, apparel, banners, invitations, coffee mugs, whatever you want to put a logo on, Vistaprint can do it for you. And they offer fantastic customer service, but better pricing than perhaps your local print shop due to the economy of scale that they have. So it's really simple to use their interface to personalize whatever you want printed. You can customize the text, the colors, backsize your business cards. They have a bunch of different templates too, if you don't necessarily have a logo related to specific industries. So that's really helpful. And they absolutely guarantee you'll love your products every time or they will make it right. They have fantastic customer service. And, of course, that special offer for my listeners, 500 business cards starting at just $9.99. Make sure you use that code CAPSPACE at checkout so that they know you came from us. So Indiana has a relatively simple offseason. They don't have any major free agents other than Jan Mahimi. Mahimi was making a bargain $4 million a year last year. He's 29, so a little bit older. His cap hold is, since he's under the estimated average player salary and they have full bird rights on him, he's 190% of that $4 million, so that is $7.6 million. And when you throw in their first-round pick and his cap hold, which they could just keep that on the books and then exceed the cap to re-sign him at the end, they have $24.8 million in space. That would go up to about $31 million were they just to let Mahimi walk. What do you think they should do about Mahimi, Danny? I think that he played really well. They have a favorable situation with his low cap hold. He's probably going to get paid more, but you can exceed the cap to re-sign him. But on the other hand, they have Miles Turner, who Nate McMillan said he sees ultimately as a center. Do you really want to invest that much in Mahimi to re-sign him, or do you want to just roll with Turner and get another $7.6 million in spending power?
I don't think that $7.6 million in spending power is going to mean a whole heck of a lot to the Pacers. I mean, it could. We don't know exactly where they're going to go, but there aren't a lot of bargains in their free agent history, you know, in terms of even like CJ Miles. I believe that was off a restricted deal from what I remember. So you have to think about.
No, they signed. I think they just signed him directly from Cleveland.
Oh, you could be right.
Part of their mid level. Yeah, CJ Miles. He's been in the league for like 12 years or something. He was like straight. He went straight out of high school.
He did.
So in like 2005. So he's been around forever.
So I think that of course there is a possibility that that money gets used, but in all likelihood, I think that it's not as big a value. The question though with Mahimi is, can you get him at an amount that will be movable if he becomes unnecessary moving forward? Because the idea with that is kind of what I've seen with Robin Lopez, which is that Robin Lopez is a nice player and the Knicks are happy to have him on his contract. But if they decided Porzingis is our center of the present, he's our center of the future, they could trade Lopez to team no problem. You know, even if they don't love him, his contract is very good. So if you could get Mahimi at that type of a number, you could do it. And also, the other important part of this is that...
Well, yeah, but yeah, I guess... But how many years is it going to
exactly.
be, you know,
too? So there's that, and then the other important part is that he has to choose it because he's an unrestricted free agent. So I think that he will... if the money is the same, I'm guessing he would go somewhere that would assure him a starting spot. And while the Pacers could maybe assure that in the short term because they can do what they did last year, they can't in the long term if Miles Turner is a big part of their future, and he better be.
Yeah, they can play those guys together. They had some success with that lineup, but I agree that Miles Turner is better as a center on both ends, especially with his shooting on offense. That really, if he extends out to the three-point line, that could really become effective much more as a center than as a power forward. And as you noted, Mahimi knows this, right? He knows that Miles Turner is the future. He's 29, so even if the Pacers match it, which I think, you know, if it's like a three-year, $45 million deal, I probably would just be willing to pay that as the Pacers under the idea that you could move him if you needed to play him together. He, you know, Mahimi fouls a lot. He's not going to play more than 25, 30 minutes a game probably anyway, but he was really good last year as a center, and he's got a little bit more in the offensive tank than maybe someone like Bismack Biyombo. I mean, not quite the defender that Bismack is, but you're right. There are plenty of teams, I think. Portland and Chicago come to the top of that list for me that would have the space for him and would be wise to make him an offer for $15 million a year for, you know, that three-year, $45 million offer for him to be your starting center for a couple of years. I think that actually would be totally good for teams like that that really have a hole in the middle.
I could add Charlotte to that list. I think he'd be great there.
Yeah, I don't know if they'll have the space. I mean, they still have Zeller there, too. But, yeah, I mean, there are plenty of other teams that could use the center. We went through them when we were talking about some of the big – I mean, Dallas is another one that absolutely could really use him.
His former team.
I think. Yeah, that's right. The Lakers, if they're trying to get better, could probably really use him. Really just – Milwaukee.
Yeah, I was just going to say Milwaukee. I'm going
through an alphabet order. We get the point. There's a lot of teams that could really use him, and even if the Pacers are willing to pony up money-wise, if I'm him, I'd rather just go somewhere where I can start. I don't have my heir apparent just waiting in the wings, but maybe he really likes it there, and he believes in the fact that he's blossomed there. And of course, you know, the fact that he's 29 is something to consider with contract talks. So let's say Mahinmi leaves. What do these guys need?
I think they need, ideally, they should have somebody who can shoot. They want shooting. They want people who can create, depending on what they're trying to do with Monte and Stuckey, and because George Hill is going to be a free agent after next year. And I also would want youth. When I wrote the Sporting News preview for these guys, I was focused on the restricted market because those are players who are more in line with their age. You know, that aren't bad now. If they added Evan Fournier, if they added Harrison Barnes, who I think should be a notable target for them, those guys fit in pretty well with Miles Turner. They're a little bit older, but they should either get better or stay the same, as opposed to getting somebody who's more on the 30 range and just isn't going to grow with this team.
Do you feel good enough with Lavoie Allen as your backup center, or do you feel like they need to add a piece there?
You'd like to upgrade over that, but I don't think that's your priority. Getting closer to an answer at the four, the two, or even a backup one who could blossom into a starter, I mean, that would be a dream. Those are bigger priorities, but they don't have to be mutually exclusive. I think you talk to the Cole Aldriches of the world, and if you can get one of them at a reasonable price, that'd be wonderful. But it's not my priority. Like, if you're trying to, I would focus this money on one or two players, ideally one. And
yeah, guys who are young.
Exactly. Like, too. You put that money into one player who will be a starter on the next great Pacers team. If they can hit on that, especially because George Hill is from, he went to Indiana school in Indianapolis, and I think he's from the area originally as well. If you can get George, Turner, and Hill, plus this other person, then you're basically one person away from having a starting five, and then you can build the bench out from there. Unfortunately, they'll have to build that bench without Solomon Hill, but that's okay.
Yeah, they declined his rookie option. We've talked about it ad nauseum. They could have had him on the books for $2.3 million. The most that they can offer him is a contract starting at $2.3 million. I think he deserves significantly more than that. His jumper was starting to come around by the end of the season. I wouldn't want to go too crazy there because he's struggled, but I think his form is good. And he can defend really probably 1 through 5 in a pinch. You know, he's kind of a mini Draymond Green. Doesn't have like the length or the force that Green has, but in terms of like how strong he is, he's definitely a guy that I really like a lot defensively. And so now they really are going to need, if they lose Mahinmi, presumably they'll move on from Jordan Hill, who is not really that good. Now either you need a four-man or, you know, a combo forward at the very least, and you're going to need another backup big too. The other thing that really is killing me about them is that they have $18 million this year tied up in Rodney Stuckey and Monte Ellis. And if they didn't have those guys on the team, they really could be a huge player in free agency. Granted, not a like enormous destination, but they could just make as many offers to restricted free agents as they could. I just feel like Stuckey and Ellis are just total like nondescript guys who don't help them all that much on either end because they're just not really that efficient and they can't shoot.
Remember when we panned those deals when it happened and a lot of people were disagreeing with us? We were right.
So here are the people I thought would, let me ask you this first. Are you okay with Joe Young / Monte as your backup point guard?
If you have to, sure. But if you can get this year's, I don't think one exists, but if you could get the equivalent of Corey Joseph, you know, a player like that, of course you want to jump on that opportunity. But I don't think this class has a guy like that unless somebody takes a shocking pay cut.
Yeah, and I mean, you have so much invested in Hill, in Ellis, and Stuckey, like you don't really want to invest more at the guard position. So the guys that I thought would be really good are the restricted free agents. You mentioned Barnes. I think Evan Fournier would be excellent for them. That would then push Paul George to the four, obviously. You would still need him to buy in there. And then you've still kind of got the same problem with Fournier, not really a combo forward guy. So George, you want him on the best wing threat. So now Fournier, just like CJ Miles, has to guard the other team's four. Like those guys are not quite big enough to be combo forwards. But Harrison Barnes would be perfect for them, I think. Mo Harkless as sort of a poor man's Barnes would be another guy, a combo forward. Alan Crabb I would like okay too, but then he's kind of a small guard. He doesn't have the versatility to play some four. So then you might also get into Luol Deng, Marvin Williams, those type of guys. But yeah, I think they really are going to want to have a combo forward to start. And I mean, it's good. Like if you have a front court of Miles Turner, who hopefully will be able to shoot the three, Marvin Williams or Barnes or Luol Deng, someone else who could shoot. Paul George, an excellent shooter. Now you're actually talking about a team that, for the first time since we could ever remember, would be like a pretty good offense with that level of spacing, I think.
And while I don't think he should be a starter, I think Lance Stephenson coming back and anchoring their second unit would be a nice fit again.
But they already have Monte Ellis. I thought of that too, but they already have Monte Ellis and Stucky. Like,
yeah.
Stephenson is basically just like another version of those
but
guys.
But he's better than them.
Is he?
I think he's better for...
I mean, defensively.
Yeah, defensively.
Yeah, I mean,
as an overall, like, force, I think he is, especially if Joe Young... We'll see what he is in terms of on-ball, off-ball. I kind of like Joe Young from what I saw from him at Oregon. I liked him a little bit better on-ball. But Lance can get after it more. I think he can give a second-unit personality. But, yeah, if you can get somebody good enough to replace Monte on the first unit, Monte as a second-unit guy would be fine.
Yeah, I would be very surprised if that happened personally. I think some other guys who might fit better for them, Matt Barnes, another guy who can play a little bit of combo forward for you. Jared Dudley, Lance Thomas would be another guy who I think would fit here pretty well. Although he's likely going back to the Clippers. Jeff Green could be, you know, kind of useful there. Derek Williams. And this is all supposing that they really do want to play a little bit smaller and faster. And Derek Williams, for example, has never played for a real defensive coach. Like, his tools aren't terrible. You know, like is he really that much slower than someone like Solomon Hill? Like, yeah, he definitely doesn't have the mentality. But, you know, if you get him the right coaching and the right culture, maybe he actually could improve defensively a little bit. He's pretty athletic. And then also, like, some backup bigs. Anybody you like on the market, they're definitely going to need, you know, at least a backup four, or maybe even someone who could start for you at the four in a pinch.
Toledovich. I really like the fit of Toledovich there.
Yeah, I think you're right. They went to Damian Rudez 2 years ago, but he was just a complete one-trick pony. Toledovich is a little bit better than that. 30 years old, you got to watch the years on him, but he should age okay. Another similar player, Anthony Tolliver, would be good. I think as a pure backup center, maybe Kevin Serafin could be someone that they could look at who, you know, he's not going to kill you if he's starting, if Miles Turner misses some time, but and is a big rim protector who could play 10 minutes a game, 15 minutes a game, because Turner, you know, both when you consider the health history with his kind of odd gait, the fact that he still is young, he's probably getting foul trouble a lot. Like, you want to have a legitimate backup center there, and maybe LaVoy Allen is like a nice plugger, not going to screw up, can get on the defensive glass, but not a guy who's going to protect the rim. So maybe they need one more big guy there, but that wouldn't be a major priority for me. I think that guys more along the lines of like Terrence Jones, Dennis Mataunas, Dwight Powell, Andrew Nicholson, more kind of stretch four-y guys would be useful for them.
Another name that I would really like to see there if they could get him is Dwayne Dedmon. I think Dedmon is a pure 5, 10 minutes a game, rim protector, would be a nice fit for them, and see if they can squeeze something a little more out of him.
So we look at where they're going to be at scheduled right now for 2017. At that point, George Hill will be 31. He'll be a free agent. His cap hold at that point will be $12 million. And then you'll also have C.J. Miles, who we haven't really mentioned it at all. I think he's someone who could bounce back a little bit for them. He'll also be a potential free agent. He's got a player option for that year. And you throw in pretty much, other than that, they've got $54.6 million in room that they're slated to have. But that's obviously minus any contracts that they dole out for this summer, plus any raises.
And that's also part of the reason why I would like to condense it into one guy or so, because there's only so much that can do. You know, if you spend $20 million on Harrison Barnes, you know, he'll go up the 4.5% off that. And it'd keep it pretty reasonable at that point, because if they spend it all and put it all in multi-year deals, then it just gets sticky, and that's exactly what they did last summer. They spent money unnecessarily. But for the right people, it's worth it, because you never know who's going to be out there, and they're probably too good to get a great pick. So, you know, they have the 20th pick this year. So you have to be wise with it, but if they're wise and proactive, I think they can do a nice job.
If they could just get, like, one really good three-point shooting combo forward, I think this team could be nasty next year. But that's going to be tough to do. You know, some of those guys are restricted. There's going to be a lot of competition for those kinds of players. But I think, and I would be willing to overpay for a guy like that, especially if they're young, and just hope that he can grow with the team, open up a new style where you can switch stuff more, shoot the three a little bit more, and then, you know, they would have to kind of phase out Monte a little bit. But even Monte, with more spacing, he can't finish at the rim as well anymore. But if you have a lot more space around him, he could be more effective, kind of the way that he was in Dallas. Some housekeeping stuff. They have a few non-guaranteed contracts on their books. Shane Whittington has a guaranteed date of August 1st. He hasn't shown a ton from what I've seen. I don't really know his game that well, frankly, but I would suspect that he's someone that might be let go, although he's making the minimum, so he only costs you about $400,000 in space over just an empty roster cap hold, which would be $540,000. Glenn Robinson III has a guaranteed date of August 1st. I think making $1 million, they probably would just keep him around. And then Joseph Young is actually guaranteed for next year. His 4-year rookie deal doesn't become unguaranteed until next year. So he'll definitely be around for sure. Rakeem Christmas, another guy who is actually guaranteed for this year, but someone I could see them just letting go or stretching or something if they need to open up just slightly more space.
It's amazing they gave him 3 guaranteed years.
Rakeem Christmas?
Yeah.
2 guaranteed
years. I believe it's 3, but either way. No.
I think it's 2. But regardless, I mean, you know, a second round pick, why not take a shot at him? And this is a team that's just not going to use.
Yeah, and the cap is rising so fast. Space. That's true. It's not that big a deal. And they got him. I think they got him in a trade with Cleveland. Is that right?
Yeah, they did. Yeah. So he's 50,000 guaranteed next year.
Oh, okay.
That's what it is. Yeah.
I need to.
I need to change
the color of him in my sheet.
All right. Anything else to say on these guys, or anything to plug before we go?
Well, yeah, so the Dallas Mavericks, one of my offseason previews, a team that we discussed at some length and some depth on this podcast, will be up tomorrow with the Sporting News. I will also have my analysis of the Game 5 that we just discussed on this podcast will be up. And, yeah, it'll be a fun week at The Athletic, and then the Sporting News, I'm going to have the offseason previews rolling out. We might even be putting some out over the weekends just because I will have all 30 written in the near future, and we just need to make sure that they're all done before July 1st because they lose a lot of value if they come out after that.
That's an excellent point. So for us, we will be back tomorrow night, Friday, with a special episode, and we're also going to do an episode on Saturday because the Warriors-Thunder Game 6, so that's why we took yesterday off so we could bring you those episodes and also get into some more off-season previews, hoping to do the Celtics one of these next couple of days, and then maybe if the Raptors get eliminated tomorrow, we'll do them as well. But looking forward to talking to you guys for those special weekend episodes. If you want to support the show, review on iTunes or a rating is definitely helpful. We're in the top 20 in the professional sports category. I think the number 2 or number 3 rated basketball podcast on iTunes, and that's a lot of that is due to those reviews and your support. So that helps new people find the show. Also, just telling your friends about us. That's really helpful as well as we get through these playoffs. And that'll do it. Talk to you all tomorrow night. Thanks again to Athletes Collective for sponsoring today's episode. They offer great quality, great fitting activewear without the logos for 30 to 40% cheaper than the big brands, and as I can attest to personal experience, just as good a quality. Go to athletescollective.com, enter the promo code CAPSPACE, and you get 15% off your first order. All orders include free shipping and returns to the U.S. or Canada, 100% satisfaction guaranteed. athletescollective.com, promo code CAPSPACE.